Welcome to Two-Way Street. The solar eclipse that'll happen on August 21st is going to be visible to all of North America, as well as parts of South America, Africa, and Europe. But while most of the world will see only a partial eclipse, people living in a narrow band crossing 14 U.S. states will be treated to the rarest of celestial phenomena, a total eclipse of the sun. The path of totality includes a sliver of the mountains of northeast Georgia. But anticipation of the eclipse is already building. Merchants are selling at a fast pace eclipse viewing glasses, t-shirts, coffee mugs, and even wines with names like Totality and Umbra. Accommodations at hotels in the area of Totality are at a premium, and remaining rooms are going to soon disappear. If I had to pick the guy who best symbolizes how much excitement the upcoming eclipse is generating, it would be David Barron, our guest today. David's a science writer who's viewed five total solar eclipses over the past two decades, and he is already in a state of exhilaration about seeing his sixth on August 21st. But even as David prepares for next month's big blackout, he's written a book about what he calls one of the most important solar eclipses in American history, the eclipse of 1878. His book is American Eclipse, a nation's epic race to catch the shadow of the moon and win the glory of the world. He'll explain why he chose that as such an important event, and he'll talk about what we can expect next month. But to start, I asked David to simply explain what a total eclipse of the sun is.
A solar eclipse, of course, occurs when the moon passes between the Earth and the sun. And so a partial eclipse, which is the most common type, if you're looking at the sun safely, which means not with the naked eye, but with very dark glasses called eclipse glasses, darker than sunglasses, you'll actually see the moon as a black kind of bite in the side of the sun. And if you, as it progresses, the bite will grow larger and larger, and the sun will become kind of a crescent. And it's all very interesting. As I say, partial solar eclipses are not that rare. But a total solar eclipse is a fundamentally different experience. It's much rarer, and when the moon completely covers the sun, it's as if you've been transported to another planet. It goes dark in the middle of the day, and you get to see a completely alien sky. It is an addictive, beautiful experience.
You experienced your first total eclipse in 1998. You were in Aruba?
Correct.
To see it?
Yep.
You describe what it was like for you that day in Aruba. What was the date?
It was February 26th, 1998.
Okay. Where were you when you saw it happen?
I was staying at the Hyatt Regency, and I just stepped out the back onto the beach, and there were lots of people out there with their eclipse glasses, some with telescopes and binoculars, and it's like everyone was very excited waiting for the show to begin.
You tell us that as a science journalist, you thought you knew what to expect, but that isn't quite the way it developed for you. If you wouldn't mind reading us that section, it's really interesting.
Right, absolutely. As a science journalist, I thought I knew what to expect. For 174 seconds, the blue sky would blacken, stars would appear, and the sun would manifest its ethereal outer atmosphere, the solar corona. What I had not anticipated was my own intense reaction to the display. For three glorious minutes, I felt transported to another planet, indeed, to a higher plane of reality, as my consciousness departed the Earth and I gaped at an alien sky. Above me, in the dim vault of the heavens, shone an incomprehensible object. It looked like an enormous wreath woven from silvery thread, and it hung suspended in the immensity of space, shimmering. As I stood transfixed by this vision, I felt something I had never experienced before, a visceral connection to the universe, and I became an umbraphile, an eclipse chaser, one who has since obsessively stalked the moon's shadow across Europe, Asia, Australia, for yet a few more fleeting moments of lunar nirvana.
It's a wonderful description. I experienced a almost complete eclipse of the sun in Atlanta. I was just trying to remember when it was. It was in the mid-80s, as I recall. I think it was like about 98% total here. And just like you, even with that little tiny piece of the sun still showing through, you're right. It transformed the landscape of Piedmont Park, where I was watching, into something completely alien, something I had never, the light was something I'd never experienced before. It really is a transformative experience, isn't it?
Right. Well, one of the points I'm going to try to make in speaking to you and to your listeners is a deep partial eclipse is really interesting, and that's what most of Georgia will see on August 21st. A total solar eclipse is mind-blowing, and that's what the very northeastern part of Georgia will see on August 21st.
Yeah, up around Clayton, Young
Way
Harris.
Way up in the northeast. The colors change, and the very quality of daylight changes. In fact, shadows look different because the sun is normally quite a large object in the sky. As it shrinks down, it becomes closer and closer to just a point source of light. And so what happens is shadows become weirdly sharp. I mean, you can, like, if you see the sun behind you and your kind of your head projected on the ground, you can see individual strands of hair. Everything is like the contrast knob had been turned up on TV. It's something, if I hadn't told you what it was and you're there, you'd know something was wrong, but it'd be hard to put your finger on it.
And now you've experienced four or five total eclipses since that first one in 1998.
Right, four since. So I've seen five total eclipses.
Where will you be for the 2017 eclipse?
Right. I've been planning for this eclipse for 19 years, since I first saw the total eclipse in Aruba in 98. And I'm going to be in Jackson, Wyoming. I live in Colorado, so that's convenient to get to. Jackson, up in the Tetons, one of the prettiest spots in the country. Also, the odds of clear skies are good in Wyoming, better there, frankly, than in the east. And so you want a clear sky. And also, I actually know precisely where I will be, which is on top of a mountain called Rendezvous Peak at 10,000 feet. And the reason I'm going to be there, I've seen five total solar eclipses. What I have not yet seen is a really good view of the moon's shadow itself racing forward. And in my book, American Eclipse, I describe what happened in 1878 for those who were on top of Pikes Peak, Colorado. They were at 14,000 feet, and they could see in the distance this enormous shaft of darkness from outer space racing toward them at 2,000 miles an hour. And they could see the distant peaks that were still in sunlight kind of popping out of sight as the shadow rushed in. And that's what I want to see.
Good for you for taking us to July 29th, 1878, because, of course, that's the solar eclipse that you have written your book about for many reasons that we'll get into. There's a couple things I'm interested in. We didn't have a great deal of scientific knowledge about eclipses at that point, and that particular eclipse, as you tell us throughout your book, really changed our body of knowledge about how what happens during an eclipse, about the sun itself. But there was still some witchcraft in those days around eclipses. Who was Ephraim or Ephraim Miller?
Yeah, so it really struck me, actually, and I'll get to that in a moment, that in 1878, for the most part, eclipse viewing was exactly the way it is today. Scientists knew how to predict the eclipse. They knew it was coming. They could map the very path where the moon's shadow would fall. And the public was very excited. In Colorado and Wyoming, newspapers were writing about it. People were very excited. In Texas, however, there was a large segment of the population that did not know it was coming. You can imagine being out in your farm field in the middle of the afternoon and suddenly it goes dark. And then you look up in the sky and there's no sun anymore, but now there's this golden crown up in the heavens. Well, folks who were particularly religious were absolutely convinced that this was Christ returning, that this was Judgment Day. And Ephraim Miller, tragically, he thought the apocalypse was coming, and he wanted to speed his transition to the other side, and he wanted to take his son with him. And he ended up with an axe killing his young son, and then with a razor taking his own life. And that, of course, was widely reported in the newspapers. But that was, even then, that was highly unusual. Most people were not scared of the eclipse, and they knew it was coming.
One of the reasons they knew it was coming, you tell us that There had been a breakthrough in the science of eclipses at a much earlier period of time. You tell me at around what time we became aware of being able to track with great certainty where an eclipse would occur.
Yeah, so actually even back ancient cultures, the Chinese, the Babylonians, the Mayans, knew that eclipses came in this 18-year cycle. And so particularly lunar eclipses or partial solar eclipses, they knew they were coming. But to map this specific path of a total eclipse, because it's only visible in a very narrow zone, about 100 miles wide, they couldn't map that. It wasn't until the early 1700s that scientists, among them Edmund Halley of Halley's Comet fame, figured out how to calculate quite an accurate path. And so by 1878, that was pretty much easy to do, although, mind you, there were no electronic computers. They had to compute the path with computers, which were people. That was a job description. And so people would calculate, these computers would calculate these very complex equations by hand.
Before we leave the supernatural nature of the solar eclipse, when I was reading your book, couldn't help but think, of course, about Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court, Mark Twain's great story about a young man who finds himself back in time, thrown back in time in King Arthur's court. And the only thing that saves him from being executed by the king's men is that he knows an eclipse, a solar eclipse, is going to take place at that spot on Earth, and is able to convince them that he's made this happen. He's used black magic. And here's what Twain writes. It grew darker and darker and blacker and blacker. Why, I struggled with awkward 6th-century clothes. It got to be pitch dark at last, and the multitude groaned with horror to feel the cold, uncanny night breeze fan through the place and see the stars come out and twinkle in the sky. At last, the eclipse was total, and I was very glad of it, but everybody else was in misery, which was quite natural.
Well, that's a wonderful description. And Twain actually missed the eclipse of 1878. He was in Europe at the time the eclipse crossed the United States. But that passage, the story is told, and I believe it's true, that what he was really influenced by was a true story of what Christopher Columbus did. And again, this is a true story. When Columbus was in the West Indies, he was having some trouble with the native population. And he had a nautical almanac. So for navigators would have these almanacs that would tell you where the various planets would be in the heavens on a given day, and so that you could actually navigate by the stars and the planets. And the nautical almanac said that a lunar eclipse was coming. And so Christopher Columbus said if the native population did not help him out with, I forget the specifics, what he wanted to do, he was going to take the moon away. He was going to turn it a blood red, and sure enough, it turned a blood red, and then he brought the moon back.
We'll take a break right now. When we come back, more with David Baron, author of American Eclipse. Black hole sun, won't you come?
Wash away the rain.
If you're just joining us, my guest on Two Way Street today is David Baron, author of American Eclipse, a nation's epic race to catch the shadow of the moon and win the glory of the world. It's the story of the solar eclipse of 1878, which Baron believes had great impact on an America still divided in the aftermath of the Civil War and a nation trying to establish its scientific credibility to the rest of the world. So there are reasons why you set your book on that date, July 29th, 1878, or wrote your book around that date. One of them is, a couple of them are, that, first of all, we had just passed the centenary of the creation of America, 1876, and America was on the move. We were moving forward. We had measured who we'd been and how far we'd come, and the sciences were really beginning to kick in, to have more an increasing importance in our lives, right? The second reason is that we were just out of the Civil War, and the country was still divided, obviously. And I think you believe that to some extent an event like this solar eclipse had the potential to sort of make us view the world, our lives in the United States, very differently, that we're a common people dealing with a common phenomenon.
Well, it really, the eclipse, as I see it, the eclipse of 1878, which was a huge public event. I mean, the newspapers were covering it, the magazines. Really was this interesting melding of politics and science. So as you said, here's this young country, just turned 100 years old, kind of looked down upon by Europe as, you know, had great industrial might, but frankly not that smart, not that intellectual. And we wanted to show what we could do in science because total eclipses were very important to astronomy at that time, and we were going to use the eclipse to do our own astronomical research. And yes, I think it also helped to kind of just rally the whole country, north and south, east and west, around a shared experience. The total eclipse was only visible in the American West. It crossed the Wild West, but the entire country got to see the partial eclipse. And newspaper reports, people in New York and Atlanta and all over the country were witnessing it and excited about it.
You build your book. There are many, many characters that we meet in your book, but you essentially build it around three people. And I want to talk about each of them because they each represent a different aspect of science and the eclipse. James Craig Watson. James Craig Watson, you tell us, was an asteroid discoverer, right?
Yeah.
That was his claim to fame. He was out there. He was an astronomer. And, well, you tell us about him.
Sure. So James Craig Watson was the head of the observatory at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. And as you say, he had a particular skill for finding asteroids. Now, back then, that was a big deal. Today, literally hundreds of thousands, if not millions of asteroids have been found. And in fact, they've been called the vermin of the skies. But back then, very few had been discovered, and finding them was a big deal. In fact, they were considered planets. They revolve around the sun. They're these rocky bodies. They're small. But they were considered minor planets. They were given names. They were put on solar system diagrams. And James Craig Watson had found more asteroids than just about anyone else on the planet. And he was in a race with another American astronomer to have that claim to be number one. So he in 1878 went out to Wyoming for the eclipse to look for a planet. Now, actually, he was looking for a specific planet called Vulcan, which we know from popular culture today, from Star Trek, but that comes from the mid-1800s when astronomers were convinced that actually there was a planet between Mercury and the sun, that Mercury was not the closest planet to the sun. They gave the planet the name Vulcan, and no one had ever reliably seen it.
Part of the reason that scientists believed there was a planet between Mercury and the sun, you tell us, is that Mercury's orbit was peculiar. It didn't behave in the way that we normally would expect a planet to orbit.
Exactly. It didn't behave according to Isaac Newton's theory of gravity in a very tiny way, but that tiny way was bugging the scientists. And the only way that they figured out to make it work was to hypothesize the existence of this other planet, Vulcan.
And it would, in a total eclipse of the sun, Watson and others thought that, and you'll explain why, that in the total eclipse, it would provide conditions that would allow them to see that planet. What was it about the eclipse that would allow them to see that planet, which of course turned out not to be there?
Right, yeah. So imagine this planet orbiting really near the sun. Well, it would never be in the sky at night because the sun's not in the sky at night. You can't see it in the daytime because it would be lost in the sun's glare. About the only time you might see Vulcan would be when the moon completely covered the sun for all of 2 or 3 minutes. You could quickly look around the sun and see if there's an object that's not on your star chart and think, well, that must be Vulcan.
So Watson was headed west to see if he could discover Vulcan. We should point out, by the way, as you do so well in the book, that Watson, that probably had no bigger fan out there in the world than he himself. He was very full of himself, as you describe him.
Well, indeed, I've often said that, I mean, I got to know these characters so well, the folks I wrote about, reading their diaries and letters and interviews with them in the newspaper, and I so wish I could have met them. Except for Watson, I guess I would have liked to have talked to him, but he was kind of a jerk. He was he had a huge, huge ego. So he's a fascinating guy, but not a very likable guy.
Well, so let's tell a little bit more, because he does think, as he's watching the eclipse, that he has spotted Vulcan. And he proclaims the discovery of a new planet. It's picked up around the world. The newspapers celebrate the discovery. Some scientists think this is an amazing breakthrough. In the long run, he's largely discredited, isn't he?
Oh, yeah. So that was the big news out of the eclipse of 1878, which was Vulcan was found, and an American found it. And who better than James Craig Watson, who was a planet hunter? It won't surprise anyone that he was wrong, but Watson, with his huge ego, could not accept that he might be wrong. And he, after the eclipse, went a little crazy. He was so convinced that it existed and he needed to restore his honor that he came up with this really kind of nutty plan for how he was going to find Vulcan without the benefit of an eclipse. And he quite literally worked himself to death. He died at age 42, 2 years later, in his quest to re-find Vulcan.
Another character in your book is Mariah Mitchell. Who is Mariah Mitchell?
I just love Mariah Mitchell. As much
sure.
as I detest James Craig Watson, I adore Mariah Mitchell, and I sure wish I could have met her. Mariah Mitchell was by far, she was an astronomer, and she was by far the most famous female scientist in America in the 19th century. She first came to prominence in 1847. She was living on Nantucket, working as a librarian by day, but she was a very serious amateur astronomer at night. And she discovered a comet before anyone else on the planet had, and for that she received a gold medal from the King of Denmark. By the 1870s, she was actually teaching as the astronomy professor at Vassar College, which had recently been founded as an all-women's college. And in 1878, and she was also, I should say, a staunch advocate of women in science and women's higher education. And in 1878, as all of these groups of men were assembling these eclipse expeditions to the West and getting a lot of help for it, frankly, from the federal government, she was excluded, but she would have none of it. And so she put together, in 1878, Mariah Mitchell put together an all-female eclipse expedition to the Wild West to Denver.
You describe in some detail how challenging it was to be a female scientist in that time period. And certainly she went through many travails trying to be accepted as an equal of the men in the field.
Absolutely. And, you can imagine, of course, just that it was an all-boys club and they didn't want women around. And they were sort of disparaging about women. But it even goes beyond that. Because, 1878 was the eclipse. This was a time when women's higher education was just getting off the ground in America, and when it was thought of as a scary experiment. What is going to happen if we start having our young women go to college? And in 1873, 5 years before the eclipse, a Harvard doctor named Edward H. Clark came out with a sensational best-selling book called Sex in Education. And his claim, and I kid you not, was that higher education could ruin a girl's health, that by sapping a girl's energy and putting it in her brain when she's maturing, education was pulling resources away from her reproductive organs. And therefore, if maturing girls use their brains too much, they'd end up as these masculine, sterile invalids. And that was a legitimate concern. And Mariah Mitchell, of course, thought it was ridiculous.
Well, it was a legitimate fake concern.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it was legitimately worried about by the public, and it needed to be rebutted. And one way to rebut it was for Mariah Mitchell to, in a very public way, take these healthy, smart, educated women out to the American West with their telescopes. There they are out on the – there's a wonderful photograph of them in Denver out on the plains of Colorado with their telescopes in their Victorian dresses. And it did help to put the to rest Edward H. Clarke's ridiculous claims.
So Mariah Mitchell also – she did have scientific goals in mind. But she also was something of an evangelist, as you've really kind of already said, for women's rights and for the treatment of women as equals in society. So both before and after the solar eclipse, she was out giving speeches. She spoke at rallies to defend the rights of women, to say, look at us, understand we are your equal, yes?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's, you know... But I'm kind of embarrassed. I really didn't know that much about 19th century U.S. history. I didn't delve very deeply into it until I wrote this book. But I spent the last 6 years really looking into it. And it's amazing how contemporary things seem, right? I mean, that here's Mariah Mitchell in 1876, 2 years before the eclipse, in Philadelphia, around the time of the centennial celebration, giving a talk called The Need of Women in Science. And she was out there speaking both about how science needs women and women need science. It's a talk you could give today.
What were her scientific goals?
Well, for the eclipse of 1878, they were pretty much what the goals of all the men's male scientists were as well. She didn't have a she wasn't specifically looking for Vulcan, but she did look for Vulcan. I mean, you have the eclipse lasted all of less than 3 minutes, and in that time, she and her party they were sketching the corona, which is the mysterious what then was a great mystery, this aura around the sun, which today we know was the sun's outer atmosphere, but they weren't sure what it was. So they were sketching it. They were looking for planets. They did look for Vulcan. They didn't find it, so they got it right. Watson got it wrong. They didn't make any great discovery during the eclipse, but Mariah Mitchell did go out and give these lectures, wonderful lectures, about her eclipse expedition and the travails that they had and the beauty of the eclipse.
It shouldn't be a surprise, given the way she'd been treated by men as a scientist, that it wasn't because men were trying to thwart her. Nevertheless, she had a last-minute challenge, you tell us. Her bags didn't get delivered properly. Her telescope went missing.
Yep.
And she didn't recover it until the last minute, and the women had to scramble just as the eclipse was approaching to set up equipment to be able to record their data.
Yeah, exactly. So again, it's very contemporary. It wasn't the airlines losing their baggage. It was the railroad companies. And the other thing they were dealing with and everyone was dealing with was the weather.
Yeah, I want to introduce your third major character here. And then let's talk about the days leading up to and the actual eclipse itself. Is that fair enough?
Absolutely.
Your third character is, I was surprised by this, Thomas Alva Edison. What the heck was Thomas Alva Edison doing thinking about solar eclipses? He was too busy, wasn't he, inventing his version of a telephone, trying to figure out electricity, and yet this consumed him for a while.
Right. So this is a young Thomas Edison, 31 years old, when he went out to Wyoming in 1878 for the total solar eclipse. And honestly, that's where my book started. When I found out that Thomas Edison, in the very year when he had just come out with the phonograph, and immediately before he began work on his incandescent lamp, Thomas Edison went to the Wild West for a total solar eclipse. I thought, there's got to be a story here. Well, the Edison we know today, of course, is the very successful Edison who sort of an icon of American history and who actually in later years was quite disparaging of academic scientists. You know, Edison was proudly—he was an inventor, and he said this.
He was
I'm
the
an
Wizard
inventor.
Of Menlo Park.
He was the Wizard of Menlo Park, New Jersey, exactly. But this young Thomas Edison— he wanted respect from the scientists. He was an inventor, but he really respected scientists and wanted to be one. And in 1878, he devised an invention specifically to study the eclipsed sun. It was called the tazimeter. And it was, today we'd call it an infrared detector. It basically was a very sensitive detector of heat. And he went out to Wyoming with a a private party of academic scientists, to study the solar corona and to see if that strange aura around the sun at the time of the total eclipse gave off heat as well as light. And so Edison, as you can imagine, he had just become a celebrity because of his recent invention of the phonograph, and the press was all over him. And in fact, the New York Herald sent a reporter specifically to report from Wyoming on Edison and his small band.
Right. His device was it strikes me his device was kind of remarkable, because what he was saying he could do with this little thing was actually measure the heat 93 million miles away of that corona around the sun.
Right. And in fact, Edison claimed that his tezimeter could measure changes in heat as small as 1/1000th of a degree Fahrenheit. And I mean, in some ways, the device did work. It was a very sensitive detector, but it was a very clunky device. It didn't really give reproducible results. And so during the eclipse, he did find heat in the corona, but in fact, he found so much, the needle flew off the scale, and he didn't have a chance to reset it and test it again.
We'll have more with author David Barron after a break. This is Two Way Street.
Good day, sunshine. Good day, sunshine. Good day, sunshine. I need to laugh. And when the sun is out, I've got something I can laugh about. Mr. Moonlight, you came to me one summer night, and from your beam you made my dream.
Let's continue our conversation with David Barron, author of American Eclipse. You really build your book around two locations, I think. Colorado, and there are various locations, I think, in Colorado. Pikes Peak, you've already mentioned, was an extraordinary vantage point, 14,000 feet. I've been to the top of Pikes Peak. It's a remarkable place to stand. You recognize how high above the earth you really are. But Pikes Peak was an important place for observation.
Pikes Peak was a remarkable place, and it was a tough place to get to, right? I mean, they walked up and they had burros to carry their equipment to the top. But even here it is the end of July, the scientists up there were dealing with snowstorms and hailstorms and severe altitude sickness. So they didn't have an easy time of it, even though they had a spectacular view. But as you say, yeah, I mean, I really am focusing on Colorado and Wyoming, and there are groups around different parts. In Colorado, it was mostly those in Denver, like Mariah Mitchell. And in Wyoming, there were three main camps spread out along the Transcontinental Railroad, where the Transcontinental Railroad intersected the path of the moon's shadow. So there were three different camps there. Edison was at one. Watson was with him much of the time, but went to another camp on eclipse day, and there are a number of other characters as well.
So in addition to scientists and curiosity seekers who traveled out west to see the solar eclipse, obviously thousands of residents of these communities were excited that they were going to be in the path of a solar eclipse. But there is the weather, and there are concerns. A cloudy sky ruins everything.
Not even a cloudy sky. A single cloud can ruin everything. I mean, all you need is one cloud in the wrong spot at the wrong time, and you miss the show. So they were fretting about the weather. I mean, it's very similar to what's done today. I mean, even back then, folks at the Weather Service, which was the National Weather Service, it was part of the Army at that time, they, months in advance, just looked back at their historical records to get a sense of where in the path of the eclipse would you most likely have clear skies. And then as the day approached, everyone was keeping a very close eye on the weather. And there was a pattern of, it seemed every afternoon, right when the eclipse was going to happen, the thunderstorms came in. And so right up to the last minute, everyone was like just holding their breath to see what would happen.
Somebody in your book is asked about it. Somebody in Colorado says it doesn't rain. It's a deluge, right?
Something like that. Cloud bursts, and that's what they were. The clouds were bursting each afternoon.
They're all gathered. The weather does provide an opportunity for everybody to see the eclipse. So when a solar eclipse begins, when the first sliver of the moon touches the sun, typically how much time passes before we're going to get to total, what's the word?
Totality.
Totality.
It's usually an hour and a quarter, hour and a half. It depends on the particular eclipse. But that's quite a long period. And so that first portion of the partial eclipse that precedes the total eclipse is quite long. And it proceeds very slowly, and you need to protect your eyes. It's not safe to look at the sun.
Because
the sun, so I want to point out, there's nothing particularly dangerous about the sun on eclipse day. The sun is always dangerous to look at. It gives off infrared radiation and a lot of energy. So you should never stare at the sun with the naked eye. And that's also true even when all that's left of the sun is a little sliver. But the partial eclipse will take an hour and a quarter, hour and a half. But as soon, if you're in the right spot where you'll have a total eclipse, as soon as it becomes total, then it actually is safe to look at with the naked eye. But it only lasts 2 or 3 minutes usually.
And it is in that time that these hundreds of scientists have to do whatever measurements, whatever studies they want to do. It is a brief, it's a fleeting moment, and they want to accomplish a lot.
Right. And so in the days leading up to the total eclipse, they're all practicing because they need to be as efficient as possible. I mean, whether it's, you know, getting their equipment pointed in the right direction, you know, they want to do as many things as possible in this less than 3 minutes. There was photography at the time, and so a number of camps had cameras, and they had to slip the glass plates in and out and do it as efficiently as possible. And in each of these scientific camps, one person was assigned actually to count the seconds, because everyone needed to know. For the first 10 seconds, they were going to do this. For the next 20 seconds, they were going to do something else. And so someone was calling out, and then they knew when the final seconds were coming.
What was learned in that eclipse of 1878? What were the important takeaways? I mean, Vulcan, if it had been real, but what was a real science that came, what we took away from that?
Right. So I have two answers to that question. So in terms of the science itself, honestly, not much, because the two big headlines out of the eclipse of 1878 were Vulcan's been found and an American found it, and Edison's tizimeter is going to be the next great invention. It's going to be bigger than the phonograph. Well, we can look back from today and realize neither of those things turned out to be true. However, from a societal standpoint, from a cultural standpoint, the eclipse of 1878 was very important, because here's this young country not sure of itself in science, in fact, not that interested in science, that suddenly gets really excited about astronomy and is cheering on its home team of astronomers and wanting us to show Europe that we were not just an economic power, we could be a scientific power. And that was a key event. It certainly was not the only one, but it was a key event at an important time as America was starting to build its scientific infrastructure. And we as a democratic nation started to decide that this was an important collective good that we should fund, we should embrace. And so really from a societal standpoint, the eclipse of 1878 had a very lasting impact.
Did it raise our standing with Europeans?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, one of the folks who was with Thomas Edison in Wyoming was a fellow named Norman Lockyer. And Norman Lockyer was a British astronomer, but he was also the founding editor of the journal Nature, which today is one of the leading journals, scientific journals in the world, comes out of London, and it was back then. And so Norman Lockyer, the voice of European science, was in America watching the American astronomers, and he was just gushing praise on what he saw here. And so his European readers realized, well, maybe America needed to be taken seriously in terms of science.
I think one of the reasons that Thomas Edison's little device did not end up being the next big thing, as you point out to us, that the very next day, he began the work that would lead to the incandescent light bulb.
Exactly. The very day that the very next day after Edison returned from Wyoming to his lab in Menlo Park, New Jersey, he started on a new project, which was incandescent lighting. There's a historical marker in Wyoming that makes the claim that it was while Edison was in Wyoming, in fact, while fishing in Wyoming, that he had this flash of inspiration and devised the incandescent light. That is not true. But there are the eclipse of 1878 did help inspire Edison to move on to electric lighting. As I said, he went west with a small band of academic scientists. And while they were traveling, while they were in the train and out there, they were talking about what was going on with people trying to develop electric lighting and electric power. And they were encouraging Edison to take this up. And Edison had been really exhausted before he went west for this trip. And it rejuvenated him both intellectually and physically. And he came back to New Jersey with these new ideas and new energy. And he took up the light bulb. And I do think there's a good chance Edison would not have been the one to invent the light bulb if he had not gone out for the eclipse.
Mariah Mitchell, also in the aftermath of the eclipse, had a pretty good career, pretty good life. Tell us about it.
Well, I mean, she was getting on in years at the time of the eclipse. In fact, she celebrated her 65th birthday in Denver when she was there. She returned to Vassar, but she started to have health problems. What she achieved, and it's the eclipse of 1878 and that trip out west was part of it, but her whole career, she just inspired the next generation of women in astronomy. And, you can really see her influence down to today, women who were inspired to go on. And even though her name's not well known today, 100 years ago it was. And the fact that this woman achieved so much in science inspired others to follow in her footsteps.
With the eclipse coming up, I think it's fair to say that the scientific interest in eclipses has waned in the years since that 1878 eclipse. There's not quite as much excitement among the science community about eclipses, is there?
No, but there is still some. So back in the 1800s, there were certain studies of the sun you could only do during a total solar eclipse. And that's why these expeditions are being sent out to the far corners of the Earth for literally 2 or 3 minutes of study. Today, we've got spacecraft that can keep an eye on the sun 24 hours a day. That said, there are certain aspects of the solar corona, the sun's outer atmosphere, that still can be studied best during a total solar eclipse. And so the eclipse this August 21st, which will be visible over land for a full hour and a half as the moon's shadow passes from Oregon to South Carolina, there are going to be a lot of scientists and citizen scientists who will be photographing and videotaping the sun. And astronomers are hoping that they'll get some new insights into kind of the details of exactly how the solar corona works.
Why do you keep going?
Oh, my goodness. Because for me, it's the most profound experience of my life, and I want to keep having it. I'm a science writer. What first took me to see a total eclipse was the science of it, but that's not what keeps me going back. I guess the word is spiritual. You know, I'm not religious in any traditional sense. But for me, looking up in the sky and seeing the sun as this beautiful kind of woven object that's shimmering out there, that it makes me feel like I am part of something much larger than myself. It both humbles me and kind of makes me feel bigger than myself. There's actually this whole new area of psychology these days studying the phenomenon of awe and how important and powerful awe is and how we Americans are deprived of awe and how awe, it dissolves the ego. It makes you feel a part of something larger than yourself. And my goodness, that's what I experienced in a total solar eclipse. And that's why I keep going back and will as long as I can.
Do you have a favorite?
My favorite was my first in Aruba, both because it was my first and also because the corona that year, and it's different every time, different, you know, every total solar eclipse has its own characteristics. The one in Aruba, the corona was unbelievable. It looked like it was made out of threads of cotton or silk, and that as if someone had, with their fingers, pinched it on two ends. And it's because, again, thinking scientifically, it's because the sun's magnetic field actually creates these different shapes of the corona, like iron filings on, you know, over a magnet. But it was just so weird and beautiful to see in the sky.
If anyone in our listening audience doubts your passion about eclipses, we'll photograph this and put it up on our website. You're wearing a necktie with a total solar eclipse depicted.
And it's not just any total solar eclipse. This is the eclipse of 1878.
Oh, it is.
This is the view from the top of Pike's Peak that was sketched up there, which I had made into a tie. This is a one-of-a-kind tie.
I did notice, I went on the website for the August, well, one of the many websites for the August 21st upcoming eclipse. And boy, there's a lot of merchandise out there. The marketers are taking full advantage of this celestial experience, David.
And so are the tourist boards and the hotels. As we are speaking now, I would bet a lot of your listeners are just hearing about it for the first time, or they heard a little bit about it. I promise you, come the beginning and middle of August, everyone will know that the eclipse is coming. But I want to point out, all of North America on August 21st will see a partial solar eclipse, and that will be interesting. Atlanta will see a 97% partial eclipse, and that, as a partial eclipse goes, is great. But a partial eclipse, even a 97% partial eclipse, you won't see the corona. It won't go dark in the middle of the day. It's not the same experience.
You talk about the fact that you are a science writer, but eclipses have brought you to what I think it's fair to say is a pretty fine attempt at poetry. Would you be willing to read the last paragraph or so of your book for us about just the emotional experience that you have? It's really beautiful, David.
What has not changed over the centuries, however, is the emotional allure of total eclipses. These rare and unearthly events, when they pass overhead, suspend human affairs and draw people out of their quotidian existence. Beholding the corona still provokes chills and tears. Some look up and find God. Others discover a new passion for science, a desire to understand the workings of the sun and solar system. The impact of eclipses remains life-changing, as I myself can wholly attest. Since my first experience of totality in Aruba in that winter of 1998, I have so far traveled four more times to meet the moon's shadow, journeys that have felt like reunions with an old acquaintance who is available only at odd intervals and seemingly random locales. In August 1999, I flew to Munich, where my observing platform, like that of the U.S. Naval Observatory Party in Central City, Colorado in 1878, was the roof of a hotel. In this case, a high terrace where guests sipped champagne and nibbled on canapes while awaiting the show. When the sun at last revealed its delicate corona, a collective cheer lifted from the darkened city, like the cry that the old newspapers say rose from Denver. Eclipses, I find, connect the present with the past like few other natural events. For me, personally, they are life milestones. Each forces me to reflect on who I was the last time I gazed at the corona. For us, collectively, as a society, a nation, a civilization, they can have the same indelible life-affirming effect. They afford a chance not only to grasp the majesty and power of nature, but to wonder at ourselves, who we are, and who we were when the same shadow long ago touched this finite orb in the boundless void.
David Barron, your book is American Eclipse, A Nation's Epic Race to Catch the Shadows of the Moon and win the glory of the world. Thank you so much for sharing your experiences and for sharing with us some of your terrific work around this book. It's really been a pleasure to have you here.
Oh, I loved it. Thank you, Bill.
Fly me to the moon. Let me play among the stars.
We're going to post on the Two-Way Street website and on our Facebook page lots of information about the August 21st solar eclipse in Georgia. We'll show you where to go to see the total eclipse, the time it'll start, and we'll give you the areas of the state where you'll see an eclipse of as much as 98%. Our website is at gpb.org/TWS, and if you go to our Facebook page, like us while you're there. Senior producer Jenny Ament edited this week's show. Our producer is Lisa Clark. Our associate producer is Olivia Rheingold. I'm Bill Nygut. See you again next week for another Two-Way Street.
In other words, please be true. In other words.